Mr. Fellwell Reel 2. You just told me about flying in the monsoon on the mail runs in India.
Yes, which was to me a very frightening experience, because you had very little say in what was happening. And suddenly you'd be plunging down 3,000 feet and then up 2,000 feet with thunder and lightning and torrential rain in the good old Dakota, which was a marvellous aeroplane as far as I was concerned. Sorry, we then converted onto Dakotas, and the only real snag on the Dakota is it used to leak badly, and we used to have to put oilskins over our knees to try and keep some of the monsoon rain off ourselves. And at that stage, we would move from Lahore down to Delhi.
Kurt, you said that you took part in the first Chindit operation.
That's right.
Can you give me some details about it, please?
Yes, well, it was Brigadier General Wingate who had got this idea that the only way to really cope with the Japanese invasion was to get behind their lines and interrupt their lines of communication. And Wingate had got Churchill's approval for this, and which made Wingate a very unpopular general in India, because Auchinleck and Slim, I mean, they had no sort of immediate access to Churchill, but Churchill and all Wingate, they got all like the house on fire. Well, having done the first expedition with Wingate, he decided he'd try a much bigger program, and we were all summoned down to Agra, and then we were taken out to this camp with Wingate, because his problem was to convince his soldiers that they could rely upon us to supply them by air. And the first time I met Wingate was in this marquee where we had dinner, and he just took over the conversation and talked, and we listened absolutely, you know, open-mouthed. And I always remember that Wingate was the first man I've ever seen to eat an orange, pips, peel, and the lot. And whilst he was still talking, and he enthused him. Well, we were able to convince, I think, the soldiers that we could, in fact, supply them.
What was he talking about?
Well, he was talking about this long-range penetration, and everything would be done from the air. The resupply, ammunition, and equally important, because on the first expedition into the jungles, the soldiers were told that if they fell sick or anything, they would be left with whatever rations there were, and that they would be dumped. And so this was not very, very inspiring to the soldiers, and therefore this time we had to reassure them that we could in fact evacuate them. And having said that, one night I landed at one of these airstrips on the Irrawaddy called Broadway, and I think it was about 150 miles behind the Japanese lines, and here were all the wounded under the trees on the stretchers. So I said to this officer, I don't know what rank he was, I said, right, well, let's get the stretchers on and let's get out of here. And this chap amazed me. He said, oh no, he said, it's not wounded tonight, it's mules. And I timed it. I said, what, mules? Yes, because we'd thrown these mules in for Wingate, and they'd all been treated somewhat with their throats, so they couldn't make a noise, and therefore they couldn't give away their presence in the jungle. And at this stage, he had so many mules blown up that he felt the need was to get these mules back to England, back to India, get them treated, and then come back again. And a mule is not a stupid animal, and having been forced into an airplane once, and then at the end of the trip got blown up, the next time it was even harder to get them back on board, which we did, and several times we brought back mules rather than humans who'd been wounded.
How did they behave in the aircraft?
Oh, well, one or two of us, not myself, but one or two of the air crew got badly bitten by mules, and so we used to load them, the army would load them on the board, and then there used to be a small door up on the port side, just behind the pilot's seat, a small little door, and we used to use a ladder and get up that way, so that then we were separated from the mules.
Did they also kick you?
Yes, they would do it, I suppose, not surprisingly. And
were these wounded mules?
Oh, yes, they were wounded mules. And I always remember with the Chindits, they had a major, Mike Calvert, and he was, he was sort of almost mythical in his reputation for doing, the bold things. And after the war, I think it's 3 years ago now, I was with the 194 squadron, my squadron's reunion with the Charing Cross Hotel in London, and I sat beside Brigadier Calvert, and I said to him, conversationally, I suppose, being an infantryman, converting to jungle warfare must have been quite a difficult thing. Oh, he said, I wasn't an infantryman, I was a Royal Engineer. And I said, what? And he said, yep. He said, I don't know how many brothers he had, but his father was a clergyman, and he got the elder brothers through university, and he said to Mike, I want you to go through university, but I can't afford it. So what you're going to do is join the army, go to Woolwich in the RE's, and get your degree through the army. He said, which I did, and he said, the thing I discovered then was I enjoyed blowing things up. So he said, the Chindit business suited me absolutely splendidly. And he was a charming man.
Did you meet him on the Chindit expeditions?
Yes, I met him twice, but obviously, I was just another air crew to him, I would think.
What happened on your meetings with him in Burma?
Well, basically, it was, you're late, or what's going to happen next, and what's the news back at Agatala, where we operated from.
And any more details you can give me about working on the Chindit expedition?
But an aside was that Wing Commander, he was known as Fatty Pearson because he was a great big chap. And one day he'd been up to Tezpur, I think it was, and he came back, landed his Dakota, and I went out to meet him. And the first thing in the doorway of this Dakota was a bear called Rupert, and which had been given to him by some tea planter, and Rupert became the squadron mascot, and he was terribly popular. And it was about 6 years ago now, I was this air crew reunion in Winnipeg, which was any air crew who'd been in battle since the Second World War II could attend. And I was amazed because 194 Squadron had their own table at this particular dinner, and there were 14 of us, and none of us had been there at the same time, but they all knew Rupert the Bear, which was our common denominator. And The other thing I was amused about was that Fatty thought we should have a squadron crest. And he wrote to the Herald of Arms, I think it was, and showing them his idea of the crest, which had Dumbo, the flying elephant, as the centerpiece. And he got such a rocket back from the Heraldry, the Herald of Arms or something, saying that, you know, this was nonsensical and, you know, what a way to treat an honest thing happening as well. And the other thing was that Freddie by then had established that our motto, and we were known everywhere as the Friendly Firm, because he'd seen this on a lorry in the hall or somewhere, and he thought it would fit with him. Because Fatty was an extraordinary chap in that he had no respect for rank, either up or down. Everybody was a human being. And, you know, whether you were an air marshal or an LAC, you always got the same treatment from Fatty Pearson.
When you landed at places like Broadway, was it difficult to do so?
Oh, it certainly was, because I remember my first landing in Broadway, and the aircraft ahead of me was flown by a flight attendant Mellish of the Royal New Zealand Air Force. And Broadway was a very difficult airfield to land at because of the mountains on either side of the river. And you went downwind prior to landing at 8,000 feet to make sure you didn't hit any of these mountains. And then you turned onto Finals at 8,000 feet, and you had these gooseneck flares, these paraffin flares. There's no glide path indicator or anything, and you had to judge it exactly right from 8,000 feet down to touching down on this gooseneck flare path. And Mellish, who I think I might say had 24 soldiers on board, he made a nonsense landing, and he was trying to go around again, and all I could see was his headlights. He'd switch on the headlights, the landing lights of the aircraft, and he went straight into one of the mountains. And so here I am in about 600 feet now, having right ahead of on the runway, or at the head of the runway, is this burning aircraft with all these dead people in it, which really sharpened up my approach procedure quite a lot.
Was Broadway the only strip that you landed at?
Oh, no. I think I might say there were about four or five of them. And but Broadway, the one I remember, A, for this appalling crash, and B, the first time I'd evacuated mules rather than wounded troops.
Did you ever get shot at by the enemy at these strips?
As far as I know, but no, we didn't. It's in fact, in one way, it was hard to believe that you were so far behind the Jap lines. But going back, a wrong amusing thing, well, I suppose it was amusing at the time, was that we were landing, or we were dropping food supplies and ammunition to the troops, and the local Naga hillmen cottoned onto this and discovered that if they put a white cross out on the football pitch, they would suddenly get a whole lot of rice or something coming down for them. And so we then had to have code names and words for dropping zones, because otherwise the Nagas used to get the supplies instead.
Was it easy to find the strips like Broadway?
To find them? Well, no, it wasn't, because A, it was at night, and B, there were no navigational aids as such, and no homing aids. The only thing you had was you could use the radio compass when you came back to coming back to base, because at our base we had got the radio equipment. But there was no radio equipment at Broadway and these other strips. So, a combination of flying at night and with no aids, it could be.
Did you see anything of the gliders used?
No, except that from Agatala, we were there with the Americans at then, because they were Hadrian gliders. And I always remember the first night when PRU, which I then left, took photographs and discovered that the Broadway, I think, was covered in logs. And this was a great, you know, to have the Japanese find out what we were doing. And quite honestly, I don't remember how they cleared that one, but the next night, certainly, the gliders went in, and there were American troops, the American aircraft, DC-3s, or Dakotas, which actually tugged easily, Hadrian gliders. And I think I might say that the accident rate was pretty phenomenal, too.
Did you enjoy this work, working with the Chindits, or was it a nightmare?
Well, funny enough, I think you were at an age where I was 23, and there was so much going on that you didn't have time to be frightened, really. But it's only recently I've been able to read books like Air Commodore Probert's book and about the Forgotten Air Force, and I realised then, you know, an awful lot was going on, but I mean, at my age and my level, you know, anything which happened outside of the squadron was nothing to do with me, that sort of thing.
Did you just meet Wingate once?
Yep. The only time, I met him once at Agatala, and again, you know, story chap, because we were trying to get these mules. We took four mules per Dakota, and we were having, well, the soldiers really, and they used to have this ramp up to the aircraft, and then they used to put a great big canvas band around the back of the mule, and then a whole lot of soldiers on either side, and virtually, you know, force it in, and this mule would not go in at all. And Wingate was there, and Wingate took hold of this halter, whatever it was, the mule, you know, had around its head and the rein thing, and then he walked it up and down, talking to it. And after 10 minutes, he walked straight up the ramp with this mule in. It was the most remarkable thing to me, it really was, that how a whole bunch of soldiers with brute force, and old Wingate took this mule on one side, talked to it, and talked and talked, and then the mule went straight up and into the aircraft. But I think, just as far as I know, those are the only times that I met. Of course, in the reunion tours we had after the war, I met his son.
Where was that time when you first met him, when he had the orange?
Oh, yes.
Where was that?
That was this camp just south of Arga. And because I remember we flew down there, we spent the night in the hotel, and it was my first glimpse of the Taj Mahal.
When he gave you that briefing near Agra,
that's right.
Did he allow you to ask questions, or did he do all the talking?
He certainly allowed us to ask questions, but I think, you know, I was thinking of my own age at the time, and we were so, you know, mesmerized by him, and I think most of us couldn't think of intelligent questions to ask him. All we knew what our job was to get the supplies there and get the wounded out, and then after that, I think, well, he gave the impression of almost invincibility. His confidence was absolutely remarkable.
What was his appearance like?
Well, he's smaller than I'd imagine him to be. He was more like the Monty figure in stature, and but otherwise, you know, he seemed. He seemed such a committed man. He really knew what he wanted to do, and he was confident that he could do it. And this confidence certainly, you know, would have affected all of us. Because I know that the next day we flew back from Agra, and you know, we were very happy to be doing the job.
Did he seem a smart man?
Did he what?
Seem a smart man?
I wouldn't have thought particularly, but mine, let's face it, in khaki shorts, khaki shirt, you know, it's very hard to look really smart, and there's where this, you know, uniform clothes, so I wouldn't know.
Did you service both Chindit expeditions?
Yeah. But the first one, I'd only just joined 194, and I did most of my time then flying the mail routes, and I did some trips with the first expedition, but the second one, you know, I was fully committed then, and I did something like 2 years with Chindit. And I always remember when he was killed in that American air crash, which really was me.
What do you remember about receiving the news of that?
Well, absolute dismay, and quite honestly, you know, I suppose we didn't see quite how the Americans could have done it, because you know, we would all then been used to flying in monsoon weather and at night over the Caracan, and how, you know, I think it was in a Mitchell, I think, he was killed, and just through flying into this mountain, you know, it seemed extraordinary that the crew couldn't, you know, which I'm sure we used to do, was add on a few thousand feet whenever we were over mountains, things to make quite sure. And as far as I know, it wasn't particularly bad weather. And to us, it was more disbelief that you know, the Americans could have had a crash like that in the circus. But I could probably discharge it to anyway. It may have been.
Apart from flying into airstrips like Broadway, mm-hmm. What other duties did you personally have with the Chindit expeditions?
Our job was just to keep the resupply and evacuating wounded, and that's what we did. And funny enough, we never really met the Chindits as such, because say we'd fly them into places like Broadway, and we'd bring them the wounded back, and as soon as we landed, they were taken out of the airport onto lorries and away they went. And so really there was no sort of intimate, you know, you didn't meet them in a mess for a beer or anything like that. It was two separate outfits. Just you had to be at the aircraft at a certain time, and a lorry would turn up with a whole lot of ammunition or men, and you just used to put it in the aircraft, go and land it, they'd get out, and that's the last you saw of them. There was no sort of kind of reunion or anything. It was very much, I suppose, in a way, rather like the post office. You know, you accept deliveries every day, but you don't really know the postman. And I think this is probably a very similar thing there.
How did the equipment behave, in particular the aircraft?
Oh, the aircraft were marvelous. They really were. The Pratt & Whitney engine was absolutely superb. And in fact, in those days, we used to clear the engines before takeoff. We used to run up the port and the starboard one. And if you had had a magneto drop, because with two magnetos to an engine, you switch that off, and in theory, it would run equally well on the other magneto. But if it had a drop, you would think the dial was wrong, not the engine, because you had so much confidence in the Pratt & Whitney, and that they were splendid in running on.
So, what else happened to you during this period with the squadron?
Well, at that stage, I then collected infected hepatitis and was repatriated to the UK.
Was this because of bad living conditions?
It could well have been, in that we lived very primitively in Agatala. It was bamboo bashes, and the mess was bamboo, and the loos or toilets were just holes in the ground, so it could have been anything like that. But I always remember, because when I recovered from infected hepatitis, I was sent back to England, and the next moment I find myself at Croydon airfield flying Croydon to Le Bourget. In other words, just the way Imperial Airways had left off before the war, and this was starting again. And the thing which still amazes me, and you know, we were down at Heathrow last month, and one day the CEO of my squadron at Croydon said, "Derek," he said, "I want you to go to Heathrow to pick up some passengers." And I said, "Where is Heathrow?" And he told me where it was, and we landed at Heathrow, and Heathrow was three marquees. Absolutely incredible. There was a sort of canteen thing in one, there was a customs and excise in another one, and I think the third one was for passengers, I think it was. But it is really incredible to see what has grown, or how big Heathrow has grown since then.
That was awesome, 1944.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. I always remember when I was in Croydon, being sent to Hendon to pick up a load for Le Bourget, and the Air Movements officer said, "How many passengers can you take?" And I adopted the good old children thing of saying, "Stick everything in